welcome feeling. I empty my mind and let the sensations run through my flesh, happy to lose myself. When Gale pulls away slightly, I move forward to close the gap, but I feel his hand under my chin. "Katniss," he says. The instant I open my eyes, the world seems disjointed. This is not our woods or our mountains or our way. My hand automatically goes to the scar on my left temple, which I associate with confusion. "Now kiss me." Bewildered, unblinking, I stand there while he leans in and presses his lips to mine briefly. He examines my face closely.
"What's going on in your head?"
"I don't know," I whisper back.
"Then it's like kissing someone who's drunk. It doesn't count," he says with a weak attempt at a laugh.
He scoops up a pile of kindling and drops it in my empty arms, returning me to myself.
"How do you know?"
I say, mostly to cover my embarrassment. "Have you kissed someone who's drunk?" I guess Gale could have been kissing girls right and left back in 12. He certainly had enough takers. I never thought about it much before. He just shakes his head.
"No, but it's not hard to imagine."
"So you never kissed any other girls?" I ask.
"I didn't say that. You know, you were only 12 when we met, and a real pain besides. I did have a life outside of hunting with you," he says, loading up with firewood.
Suddenly, I'm genuinely curious.
"Who did you kiss, and where?" "Too many to remember. Behind the school, on the slag heap, you name it," he says.
I roll my eyes.
"So when did I become so special? When they carted me off to the capital?"
"No, about 6 months before that, right after New Year's. We were in the hob, eating some slop of greasy says, and Darius was teasing you about trading a rabbit for one of his kisses, and I realized."
"I minded," he tells me.
I remember that day, bitter cold and dark by 4 in the afternoon. We'd been hunting, but a heavy snow had driven us back into town. The hob was crowded with people looking for refuge from the weather. Greasy Say's soup, made with stock from the bones of a wild dog we'd shot a week earlier, was below her usual standards. Still, it was hot, and I was starving as I scooped it up, sitting cross-legged on her counter. Darius was leaning on the post of the stall, tickling my cheek with the end of my braid while I smacked his hand away. He was explaining why one of his kisses merited a rabbit, or possibly two, since everyone knows red-headed men are the most virile. And Greasy Say and I were laughing because he was so ridiculous and persistent and kept pointing out women around the hob, who he said had paid far more than a rabbit to enjoy his lips.
"See? The one in the green muffler?
Go ahead and ask her, if you need a reference." A million miles from here, a billion days ago, this happened. "Darius was just joking around," I say.
"Probably. Although you'd be the last to figure out if he wasn't," Gale tells me. "Take Peeta, take me, or even Finnick. I was starting to worry he had his eye on you, but he seems back on track now."
"You don't know Finnick if you think he'd love me," I say. Gale shrugs.
"I know he was desperate. That makes people do all kinds of crazy things."
I can't help thinking that's directed at me. Bright and early the next morning, the brains assemble to take on the problem of the nut. I'm asked to the meeting, although I don't have much to contribute. I avoid the conference table and perch in the wide windowsill that has a view of the mountain in question. The commander from 2, a middle-aged woman named Lime, takes us on a virtual tour of the nut, its interior and fortifications, and recounts the failed attempts to seize it. I've crossed paths with her briefly a couple of times since my arrival, and was dogged by the feeling I'd met her before. She's memorable enough, standing over 6 feet tall and heavily muscled,
but it's only when I see a clip of her in the field, leading a raid on the main entrance of the Nut, that something clicks and I realize I'm in the presence of another victor. Lime, the tribute from District 2, who won her Hunger Games over a generation ago. Effie sent us her tape, among others, to prepare for the Quarter Quell. I've probably caught glimpses of her during the games over the years, but she's kept a low profile. With my newfound knowledge of Haymitch's and Finnick's treatment, all I can think is, what did the Capitol do to her after she won? When Lime finishes the presentation, the questions from the brains begin. Hours pass, and lunch comes and goes, as they try to come up with a realistic plan for taking the Nut. But while Beatty thinks he might be able to override certain computer systems, and there's some discussion of putting the handful of internal spies to use, no one has any really innovative thoughts. As the afternoon wears on, talk keeps returning to a strategy that has been tried repeatedly, the storming of the entrances. I can see Lime's frustration building because so many variations of this plan have already failed. So many of her soldiers have been lost. Finally, she bursts out. The next person who suggests we take the entrances better have a brilliant way to do it, because you're going to be the one leading that mission. Gail, who is too restless to sit at the table for more than a few hours, has been alternating between pacing and sharing my windowsill. Early on, he seemed to accept Lime's assertion that the entrances couldn't be taken and dropped out of the conversation entirely. For the last hour or so, he sat quietly, his brow knitted in concentration, staring at the Nut through the window glass. In the silence that follows Lime's ultimatum, he speaks up. Is it really so necessary that we take the Nut? Or would it be enough to disable it?
That would be a step in the right direction, says Beatty. What do you have in mind?
Think of it as a wild dog den, Gale continues. You're not going to fight your way in, so you have two choices. Trap the dogs inside or flush them out. We've tried bombing the entrances, says Lime. They're set too far inside the stone for any real damage to be done.
I wasn't thinking of that, says Gale. I was thinking of using the mountain.
Beatty rises and joins Gale at the window, peering through his ill-fitting glasses. See? Running down the sides?
Avalanche paths, says Beatty under his breath.
It'd be tricky. We'd have to design the detonation sequence with great care, and once it's in motion, we couldn't hope to control it.
We don't need to control it if we give up the idea that we have to possess the Nut, says Gale.
Only shut it down. So you're suggesting we start avalanches and block the entrances? Asks Lime.
That's it, says Gale. Trap the enemy inside, cut off from supplies, make it impossible for them to send out their hovercraft.
While everyone considers the plan, Boggs flips through a stack of blueprints of the Nut and frowns.
You risk killing everyone inside. Look at the ventilation system. It's rudimentary at best. Nothing like what we have in 13.
It depends entirely on pumping in air from the mountainsides. Block those vents, and you'll suffocate whoever is trapped.
They could still escape through the train tunnel to the square, says Beatty.
Not if we blow it up, says Gale brusquely. His intent, his full intent, becomes clear. Gale has no interest in preserving the lives of those in the Nut, no interest in caging the prey for later use. This is one of his death traps.
Chapter 15. The implications of what Gale is suggesting settle quietly around the room. You can see the reaction playing out on people's faces. The expressions range from pleasure to distress, from sorrow to satisfaction.
The majority of the workers are citizens from 2, says Beatty neutrally.
So what? Says Gale. We'll never be able to trust them again.
They should at least have a chance to surrender, says Lime.
Well, that's a luxury we weren't given when they firebombed 12, but you're all so much cozier with the capital here, says Gale.
By the look on Lime's face, I think she might shoot him, or at least take a swing. She'd probably have the upper hand, too, with all her training. But her anger only seems to infuriate him, and he yells,
We watched children burn to death, and there was nothing we could do.
I have to close my eyes a minute as the image rips through me. It has the desired effect. I want everyone in that mountain dead. I'm about to say so, but then I'm also a girl from District 12.
Not President Snow.
I can't help it. I can't condemn someone to the death he's suggesting. Gale, I say, taking his arm and trying to speak in a reasonable tone. The nut's an old mine. It'd be like causing a massive coal mining accident. Surely the words are enough to make anyone from 12 think twice about the plan.
But not so quick as the one that killed our fathers, he retorts. Is that everyone's problem? That our enemies might have a few hours to reflect on the fact that they're dying instead of just being blown to bits?
Back in the old days, when we were nothing more than a couple of kids hunting outside of 12, Gale said things like this and worse. But then they were just words. Here, put into practice, they become deeds that can never be reversed. You don't know how those District 2 people ended up in the nut, I say. They may have been coerced. They may be held against their will. Some are our own spies. Will you kill them, too?
I would sacrifice a few, yes, to take out the rest of them, he replies. And if I were a spy in there, I'd say, bring on the avalanches.
I know he's telling the truth, that Gale would sacrifice his life in this way for the cause. No one doubts it. Perhaps we'd all do the same if we were the spies and given the choice. I guess I would. But it's a cold-hearted decision to make for other people and those who love them.
You said we had two choices, Boggs tells him, to trap them or to flush them out. I say we try to avalanche the mountain, but leave the train tunnel alone. People can escape into the square, where we'll be waiting for them. Heavily armed, I hope, says Gale. You can be sure they'll be. Heavily armed. We'll take them prisoner, agrees Boggs.
Let's bring 13 into the loop now, Beatty suggests. Let President Coyne weigh in.
She'll want to block the tunnel, says Gale with conviction.
Yes, most likely. But, you know, Peter did have a point in his propos about the dangers of killing ourselves off. I've been playing with some numbers, factoring in the casualties and the wounded, and I think it's at least worth a conversation, says Beatty.
Only a handful of people are invited to be part of that conversation. Gale and I are released with the rest. I take him hunting so he can blow off some steam, but he's not talking about it, probably too angry with me for countering him. The call does happen. A decision is made, and by evening I'm suited up in my Mockingjay outfit with my bow slung over my shoulder and an earpiece that connects me to Haymitch in 13, just in case a good opportunity for a propos arises. We wait on the roof of the Justice Building with a clear view of our target. Our hoverplanes are initially ignored by the commanders in the nut, because in the past they've been little more trouble than flies buzzing around a honeypot. But after two rounds of bombings in the higher elevations of the mountain, the planes have their attention. By the time the Capitol's anti-aircraft weapons begin to fire, it's already too late. Gale's plan exceeds anyone's expectations. Beatty was right about being unable to control the avalanches once they'd been set in motion. The mountainsides are naturally unstable, but weakened by the explosions, they seem almost fluid. Whole sections of the nut collapse before our eyes, obliterating any sign that human beings have ever set foot on the place. We stand speechless, tiny and insignificant,
as waves of stone thunder down the mountain, burying the entrances under tons of rock, raising a cloud of dirt and debris that blackens the sky, turning the nut into a tomb. I imagine the hell inside the mountain. Sirens wailing, lights flickering into darkness, stone dust choking the air. The shrieks of panicked, trapped beings stumbling madly for a way out, only to find the entrances, the launch pad, the ventilation shafts themselves clogged with earth and rock trying to force its way in. Live wires flung free. Fires breaking out, rubble making a familiar path a maze. People slamming, shoving, scrambling like ants as the hill presses in, threatening to crush their fragile shells. Katniss! Haymitch's voice is in my earpiece. I try to answer back and find both of my hands are clamped tightly over my mouth. Katniss! On the day my father died, the sirens went off during my school lunch. No one waited for dismissal or was expected to. The response to a mine accident was something outside the control of even the Capitol. I ran to Prim's class. I still remember her, tiny at 7, very pale, but sitting straight up with her hands folded on her desk, waiting for me to collect her as I'd promised I would if the sirens ever sounded. She sprang out of her seat, grabbed my coat sleeve, and we wove through the streams of people pouring out onto the streets to pool at the main entrance of the mine. We found our mother clenching the rope that had been hastily strung to keep the crowd back. In retrospect, I guess I should have known there was a problem right then, because why were we looking for her when the reverse should have been true? The elevators were screeching, burning up and down their cables as they vomited smoke-blackened miners into the light of day. With each group came cries of relief, relatives diving under the rope to lead off their husbands, wives, children, parents, siblings. We stood in the freezing air as the afternoon turned overcast. A light snow dusted the earth. The elevators moved more slowly now and disgorged fewer beings. I knelt on the ground and pressed my hands into the cinders, wanting so badly to pull my father free. If there's a more helpless feeling than trying to reach someone you love who's trapped underground, I don't know it. The wounded, the bodies, the waiting through the night, blankets put around your shoulders by strangers, a mug of something hot that you don't drink. And then finally, at dawn, the grieved expression on the face of the mine captain that could only mean one thing. What did we just do? Katniss, are you there? Haymitch is probably making plans to have me fitted for a head shackle at this very moment. I drop my hands. Yes. Get inside, just in case the Capitol tries to retaliate with what's left of its air force, he instructs. Yes, I repeat. Everyone on the roof, except for the soldiers manning the machine guns, begins to make their way inside. As I descend the stairs, I can't help brushing my fingers along the unblemished white marble walls. So cold and beautiful. Even in the Capitol, there's nothing to match the magnificence of this old building. But there is no give to the surface. Only my flesh yields. My warmth taken. Stone conquers people every time. I sit at the base of one of the gigantic pillars in the great entrance hall. Through the doors, I can see the white expanse of marble that leads to the steps on the square. I remember how sick I was the day Peter and I accepted congratulations there for winning the games, worn down by the victory tour. Failing in my attempt to calm the districts, facing the memories of Clove and Cato, particularly Cato's gruesome, slow death by mutts. Boggs crouches down beside me, his skin pale in the shadows.
We didn't bomb the train tunnel, you know. Some of them will probably get out.
And then we'll shoot them when they show their faces? I ask.
Only if we have to, he answers.
We could send in trains ourselves,
help evacuate the wounded, I say.
No, it was decided to leave the tunnel in their hands. That way they can use all the tracks to bring people out, says Boggs. Besides, it will give us time to get the rest of our soldiers to the square.
A few hours ago, the square was a no-man's land, the front line of the fight between the rebels and the peacekeepers. When Coyne gave approval for Gale's plan, the rebels launched a heated attack and drove the capital forces back several blocks so that we would control the train station in the event that the nut fell. Well, it's fallen. The reality has sunk in. Any survivors will escape to the square. I can hear the gunfire starting again, as the peacekeepers are no doubt trying to fight their way in to rescue their comrades. Our own soldiers are being brought in to counter this.
You're cold, says Boggs. I'll see if I can find a blanket.
He goes before I can protest. I don't want a blanket, even if the marble continues to leech my body heat.
Katniss,
says Haymitch in my ear. Still here, I answer.
Interesting turn of events with PETA this afternoon. Thought you'd want to know, he says.
Interesting isn't good. It isn't better. But I don't really have any choice but to listen.
We showed him that clip of you singing, The Hanging Tree. It was never aired, so the Capitol couldn't use it when he was being hijacked. He says he recognized the song.
For a moment, my heart skips a beat. Then I realize it's just more Tracker Jacker serum confusion. He couldn't, Haymitch. He never heard me sing that song.
Not you. Your father. He heard him singing it one day when he came to trade at the bakery.
Peter was small, probably 6 or 7, but he remembered it because he was specially listening to see if the birds stopped singing, says Haymitch.
Guess they did.
6 or 7. That would have been before my mother banned the song, maybe even right around the time I was learning it. Was I there, too?
Don't think so. No mention of you, anyway. But it's the first connection to you that hasn't triggered some mental meltdown, says Haymitch. It's something at least, Katniss.
My father, he seems to be everywhere today, dying in the mine, singing his way into PETA's muddled consciousness, flickering in the look Boggs gives me as he protectively wraps the blanket around my shoulders. I miss him so badly, it hurts. The gunfire's really picking up outside. Gale hurries by with a group of rebels, eagerly headed for the battle. I don't petition to join the fighters, not that they would let me. I have no stomach for it anyway, no heat in my blood. I wish PETA was here, the old PETA, because he would be able to articulate why it is so wrong to be exchanging fire when people... any people are trying to claw their way out of the mountain. Or is my own history making me too sensitive? Aren't we at war? Isn't this just another way to kill our enemies? Night falls quickly. Huge bright spotlights are turned on, illuminating the square. Every bulb must be burning at full wattage inside the train station as well. Even from my position across the square, I can see clearly through the plate glass front of the long, narrow building. It would be impossible to miss the arrival of a train, or even a single person. But hours pass, and no one comes. With each minute, it becomes harder to imagine that anyone survived the assault on the nut. It's well after midnight when Cressida comes to attach a special microphone to my costume. "What's this for?" I ask. Haymitch's voice comes on to explain.
I know you're not going to like this, but we need you to make a speech.
A speech? I say, immediately feeling queasy.
I'll feed it to you line by line,
he assures me.
You'll just have to repeat what I say. Look, there's no sign of life from that mountain. We've won, but the fighting's continuing, so we thought if you went out on the steps of the Justice Building and laid it out... told everybody that the nut's defeated, that the Capitol's presence in District 2 is finished, you might be able to get the rest of their forces to surrender.
I peer at the darkness beyond the square. I can't even see their forces.
That's what the mic's for, he says. You'll be broadcast, both your voice through their emergency audio system and your image wherever people have access to a screen.
I know there are a couple of huge screens here on the square. I saw them on the Victory Tour. It might work if I were good at this sort of thing, which I'm not. They tried to feed me lines in those early experiments with the propos, too, and it was a flop.
You could save a lot of lives, Katniss, Haymitch says finally.
All right, I'll give it a try, I tell him. It's strange, standing outside at the top of the stairs, fully costumed, brightly lit, but with no visible audience to deliver my speech to, like I'm doing a show for the moon.
Let's make this quick, says Haymitch. You're too exposed.
My television crew, positioned out in the square with special cameras, indicates that they're ready. I tell Haymitch to go ahead, then click on my mic and listen carefully to him dictate the first line of the speech. A huge image of me lights up one of the screens over the square as I begin.
People of District 2, this is Katniss Everdeen speaking to you from the steps of your Justice Building, where...
The pair of trains come screeching into the train station side by side. As the doors slide open, people tumble out in a cloud of smoke they've brought from the Nut. They must have had at least an inkling of what would await them at the square, because you can see them trying to act evasively. Most of them flatten on the floor, and a spray of bullets inside the station takes out the lights. They've come armed, as Gale predicted, but they've come wounded as well. The moans can be heard in the otherwise silent night air. Someone kills the lights on the stairs, leaving me in the protection of shadow. A flame blooms inside the station. One of the trains must actually be on fire, and a thick black smoke billows against the windows. Left with no choice, the people begin to push out into the square, choking but defiantly waving their guns. My eyes dart around the rooftops that ring the square. Every one of them has been fortified with rebel-manned machine-gun nests. Moonlight glints off oiled barrels. A young man staggers out from the station, one hand pressed against a bloody cloth at his cheek, the other dragging a gun. When he trips and falls to his face, I see the scorch marks down the back of his shirt, the red flesh beneath, and suddenly he's just another burn victim from a mine accident. My feet fly down the steps, and I take off running for him. Stop! I yell at the rebels. Hold your fire! The words echo around the square and beyond as the mic amplifies my voice. Stop! I'm nearing the young man, reaching down to help him, when he drags himself up to his knees and trains his gun on my head. I instinctively back up a few steps, raise my bow over my head to show my intention was harmless. Now that he has both hands on his gun, I notice the ragged hole in his cheek, where something, falling stone maybe, punctured the flesh. He smells of burning things, hair and meat and fuel. His eyes are crazed with pain and fear.
Freeze!
Haymitch's voice whispers in my ear. I follow his order, realizing that this is what all of District 2, all of Panem, maybe, must be seeing at the moment. The mockingjay at the mercy of a man with nothing to lose. His garbled speech is barely comprehensible.
Give me one reason I shouldn't shoot you.
The rest of the world recedes. There's only me looking into the wretched eyes of the man from the Nut who asks for one reason. Surely I should be able to come up with thousands, but the words that make it to my lips are, I can't. Logically, the next thing that should happen is the man pulling the trigger. But he's perplexed, trying to make sense of my words. I experience my own confusion as I realize what I've said is entirely true, and the noble impulse that carried me across the square is replaced by despair. I can't. That's the problem, isn't it? I lower my bow,
We blew up your mine. You burned my district to the ground. We've got every reason to kill each other. So do it. Make the capital happy. I'm done killing their slaves for them. I drop my bow on the ground and give it a nudge with my boot. It slides across the stone and comes to rest at his knees.
I'm not their slave, the man mutters.
I am, I say. That's why I killed Cato, and he killed Thresh, and he killed Clove, and she tried to kill me. It just goes around and around, and who wins? Not us, not the districts, always the capital. But I'm tired of being a piece in their games.
Peeta, on the rooftop the night before our first Hunger Games, he understood it all before we'd even set foot in the arena. I hope he's watching now, that he remembers that night as it happened, and maybe forgives me when I die.
Keep talking. Tell him about watching the mountain go down, Haymitch insists.
When I saw that mountain fall tonight, I thought, they've done it again, got me to kill you, the people in the districts. But why did I do it? District 12 and District 2 have no fight except the one the capital gave us. The young man blinks at me uncomprehendingly. I sink on my knees before him, my voice low and urgent.
And why are you fighting with the rebels on the rooftops? With Lyme, who was your victor? With people who were your neighbors, maybe even your family?
I don't know, says the man, but he doesn't take his gun off me.
I rise and turn slowly in a circle, addressing the machine guns. And you up there! I come from a mining town. Since when do miners condemn other miners to that kind of death, and then stand by to kill whoever manages to crawl from the rubble?
Who is the enemy? Whispers Haymitch.
These people, I indicate the wounded bodies on the square, are not your enemy. I whip back around to the train station. The rebels are not your enemy. We all have one enemy, and it's the capital. This is our chance to put an end to their power, but we need every district person to do it. The cameras are tight on me as I reach out my hands to the man, to the wounded, to the reluctant rebels across Panem. Please, join us. My words hang in the air. I look to the screen, hoping to see them recording some wave of reconciliation going through the crowd. Instead, I watch myself get shot on television.
Chapter 16.
Always. In the twilight of Morphling, Peeta whispers the word, and I go searching for him. It's a gauzy, violet-tinted world with no hard edges and many places to hide. I push through cloud banks, follow faint tracks, catch the scent of cinnamon, of dill. Once I feel his hand on my cheek and try to trap it, but it dissolves like mist through my fingers. When I finally begin to surface into the sterile hospital room in 13, I remember. I was under the influence of sleep syrup. My heel had been injured after I'd climbed out on a branch over the electric fence and dropped back into 12. Peeta had put me to bed, and I had asked him to stay with me as I was drifting off. He had whispered something I couldn't quite catch, but some part of my brain had trapped his single word of reply and let it swim up through my dreams to taunt me now. Always. Morphling dulls the extremes of all emotions, so instead of a stab of sorrow, I merely feel emptiness. A hollow of dead brush where flowers used to bloom. Unfortunately, there's not enough of the drug left in my veins for me to ignore the pain in the left side of my body. That's where the bullet hit. My hands fumble over the thick bandages encasing my ribs, and I wonder what I'm still doing here. It wasn't him,
the man kneeling before me on the square, the burned one from the nut. He didn't pull the trigger. It was someone farther back in the crowd. There was less a sense of penetration than the feeling that I'd been struck with a sledgehammer. Everything after the moment of impact is confusion, riddled with gunfire. I try to sit up, but the only thing I manage is a moan. The white curtain that divides my bed from the next patient's whips back, and Joanna Mason stares down at me. At first I feel threatened, because she attacked me in the arena. I have to remind myself that she did it to save my life. It was part of the rebel plot. But still, that doesn't mean she doesn't despise me. Maybe her treatment of me was all an act for the Capitol.
"I'm alive?"
I say rustily.
"No kidding, brainless."
Joanna walks over and plunks down on my bed, sending spikes of pain shooting across my chest. When she grins at my discomfort, I know we're not in for some warm reunion scene.
"Still a little sore?"
With an expert hand, she quickly detaches the morphling drip from my arm and plugs it into a socket taped into the crook of her own.
"They started cutting back my supply a few days ago. Afraid I'm going to turn into one of those freaks from Six. I've had to borrow from you when the coast was clear. Didn't think you'd mind."
Mind? How can I mind when she was almost tortured to death by snow after the quarter quell? I have no right to mind, and she knows it. Joanna sighs as the morphling enters her bloodstream.
"Maybe they were on to something in Six. Drug yourself out and paint flowers on your body. Not such a bad life. Seemed happier than the rest of us, anyway."
In the weeks since I left 13, she's gained some weight back. A soft down of hair has sprouted on her shaved head, helping to hide some of the scars. But if she's siphoning off my morphling, she's struggling.
"They've got this head doctor who comes around every day, supposed to be helping me recover. Like some guy who spent his life in this rabbit warren's gonna fix me up? Complete idiot. At least 20 times a session, he reminds me that I'm totally safe."
I manage a smile. It's a truly stupid thing to say, especially to a victor. As if such a state of being ever existed anywhere for anyone.
"How about you, Mockingjay? You feel totally safe?"
"Oh, yeah. Right up until I got shot," I say.
"Please, that bullet never even touched you. Sinna saw to that," she says.
I think of the layers of protective armor in my Mockingjay outfit, but the pain came from somewhere.
"Broken ribs?" "Not even. Bruised pretty good. The impact ruptured your spleen. They couldn't repair it."
She gives a dismissive wave of her hand.
"Don't worry, you don't need one. And if you did, they'd find you one, wouldn't they? It's everybody's job to keep you alive."
"Is that why you hate me?" I ask.
"Partly," she admits. "Jealousy is certainly involved. I also think you're a little hard to swallow, with your tacky romantic drama and your defender of the helpless act. Only it isn't an act, which makes you more unbearable. Please. Feel free to take this personally."
"You should have been the Mockingjay. No one would have had to feed you lines," I say.
"True, but no one likes me," she tells me.
"They trusted you, though, to get me out," I remind her,
"and they're afraid of you." "Here, maybe. In the Capitol, you're the one they're scared of now."
Gail appears in the doorway, and Joanna neatly unhooks herself and reattaches me to the morphling drip.
"Your cousin's not afraid of me," she says confidentially.
She scoots off my bed and crosses to the door, nudging Gale's leg with her hip as she passes him.
"Are you gorgeous?"
We can hear her laughter as she disappears down the hall. I raise my eyebrows at him as he takes my hand.
"Terrified," he mouths.
I laugh, but it turns into a wince.
"Easy."
He strokes my face as the pain ebbs.
"You've got to stop running straight into trouble."
"I know,"
But someone blew up a mountain, I answer. Instead of pulling back, he leans in closer, searching my face.
You think I'm heartless?
I know you're not, but I won't tell you it's okay, I say. Now he draws back, almost impatiently.
Katniss, what difference is there, really, between crushing our enemy in a mine or blowing them out of the sky with one of Beatty's arrows? The result is the same.
I don't know. We were under attack in 8, for one thing. The hospital was under attack, I say.
Yes, and those hover planes came from District 2, he says. So by taking them out, we prevented further attacks.
But that kind of thinking, you could turn it into an argument for killing anyone at any time. You could justify sending kids into the Hunger Games to prevent the districts from getting out of line, I say.
I don't buy that, he tells me.
I do, I reply. It must be those trips to the arena.
Fine. We know how to disagree, he says. We always have. Maybe it's good. Between you and me, we've got District 2 now.
Really? For a moment, a feeling of triumph flares up inside me. Then I think about the people on the square. Was there fighting after I was shot?
Not much. The workers from the Nut turned on the Capitol soldiers. The rebels just sat by and watched, he says. Actually, the whole country just sat by and watched.
Well, that's what they do best, I say. You'd think that losing a major organ would entitle you to lie around a few weeks, but for some reason, my doctors want me up and moving almost immediately. Even with the morphling, the internal pain's severe the first few days, but then it slacks off considerably. The soreness from the bruised ribs, however, promises to hang on for a while. I begin to resent Joanna dipping into my morphling supply, but I still let her take whatever she likes. Rumors of my death have been running rampant, so they send in the team to film me in my hospital bed. I show off my stitches and impressive bruising and congratulate the districts on their successful battle for unity. Then I warn the Capitol to expect us soon. As part of my rehabilitation, I take short walks above ground each day. One afternoon, Plutarch joins me and gives me an update on our current situation. Now that District 2 has allied with us, the rebels are taking a breather from the war to regroup. Fortifying supply lines, seeing to the wounded, reorganizing their troops. The capital, like 13 during the dark days, finds itself completely cut off from outside help as it holds the threat of nuclear attack over its enemies. Unlike 13, the capital is not in a position to reinvent itself and become self-sufficient.
Oh, the city might be able to scrape along for a while, says Plutarch. Certainly, there are emergency supplies stockpiled, but the significant difference between 13 and the capital are the expectations of the populace. 13 was used to hardship, whereas in the capital, all they've known is panem et circenses.
What's that? I recognize panem, of course, but the rest is nonsense.
It's a saying from thousands of years ago, written in a language called Latin about a place called Rome, he explains. Panem et circenses translates into bread and circuses. The writer was saying that in return for full bellies and entertainment, his people had given up their political responsibilities and therefore their power.
I think about the capital, the excess of food, and the ultimate entertainment, the Hunger Games. So that's what the districts are for? To provide the bread and circuses?
Yes, and as long as that kept rolling in, the capital could control its little empire. Right now, they can provide neither, at least at the standard the people are accustomed to, says Plutarch. We have the food, and I'm about to orchestrate an entertainment propo that's sure to be popular. After all, everybody loves a wedding.
I freeze in my tracks,
sick at the idea of what he's suggesting. Somehow staging some perverse wedding between Peeta and me. I haven't been able to face that one-way glass since I've been back, and at my own request, only get updates about Peeta's condition from Haymitch. He speaks very little about it. Different techniques are being tried. There will never truly be a way to cure him. And now they want me to marry Peeta for a propo? Plutarch rushes to reassure me.
Oh, no, Katniss, not your wedding, Finnegan Annie's. All you need to do is show up and pretend to be happy for them.
That's one of the few things I won't have to pretend, Plutarch, I tell him. The next few days bring a flurry of activity as the event is planned. The differences between the Capitol and 13 are thrown into sharp relief by the event. When Coyne says, wedding, she means two people signing a piece of paper and being assigned a new compartment. Plutarch means hundreds of people dressed in finery at a three-day celebration. It's amusing to watch them haggle over the details. Plutarch has to fight for every guest, every musical note. After Coyne vetoes a dinner, entertainment, and alcohol, Plutarch yells,
"What's the point of the propo if no one's having any fun?"
It's hard to put a game maker on a budget. But even a quiet celebration causes a stir in 13, where they seem to have no holidays at all. When it's announced that children are wanted to sing District 4's wedding song, practically every kid shows up. There's no shortage of volunteers to help make decorations. In the dining hall, people chat excitedly about the event. Maybe it's more than the festivities. Maybe it's that we are all so starved for something good to happen that we want to be part of it. It would explain why, when Plutarch has a fit over what the bride will wear, I volunteer to take Annie back to my house in 12, where Cinna left a variety of evening clothes in a big storage closet downstairs. All of the wedding gowns he designed for me went back to the Capitol, but there are some dresses I wore on the victory tour. I'm a little leery about being with Annie, since all I really know about her is that Finnick loves her and everybody thinks she's mad. On the hovercraft ride, I decide she's less mad than unstable. She laughs at odd places in the conversation or drops out of it distractedly. Those green eyes fixate on a point with such intensity that you find yourself trying to make out what she sees in the empty air. Sometimes, for no reason, she presses both her hands over her ears as if to block out a painful sound. All right, she's strange, but if Finnick loves her, that's good enough for me. I got permission for my prep team to come along, so I'm relieved of having to make any fashion decisions. When I open the closet, we all fall silent because Cinna's presence is so strong in the flow of the fabrics. Then Octavia drops to her knees, rubs the hem of a skirt against her cheek, and bursts into tears.
"It's been so long," she gasps, "since I've seen anything pretty."
Despite reservations on Coyne's side that it's too extravagant and on Plutarch's side that it's too drab, the wedding is a smash hit. The 300 lucky guests culled from 13 and the many refugees wear their everyday clothes. The decorations are made from autumn foliage. The music is provided by a choir of children, accompanied by the lone fiddler who made it out of 12 with his instrument. So it's simple, frugal by the Capitol's standards. It doesn't matter because nothing can compete with the beauty of the couple. It isn't about their borrowed finery. Annie wears a green silk dress I wore in 5, Finnick one of Peeta's suits that they altered. Although the clothes are striking, who can look past the radiant faces of two people for whom this day was once a virtual impossibility? Dalton, the cattle guy from 10, conducts the ceremony, since it's similar to the one used in his district. But there are unique touches of District 4, a net woven from long grass that covers the couple during their vows. the touching of each other's lips with salt water, and the ancient wedding song, which likens marriage to a sea voyage. No, I don't have to pretend to be happy for them. After the kiss that seals the union, the cheers, and a toast with apple cider, the fiddler strikes up a tune that turns every head from 12. We may have been the smallest, poorest district in Panem, but we know how to dance. Nothing has been officially scheduled at this point, but Plutarch, who's calling the propo from the control room, must have his fingers crossed. Sure enough, Greasy Say grabs Gale by the hand and pulls him into the center of the floor and faces off with him. People pour in to join them, forming two long lines, and the dancing begins. I'm standing off to the side, clapping to the rhythm, when a bony hand pinches me above the elbow. Joanna scowls at me. Are you going to miss the chance to let Snow see you dancing? She's right. What could spell victory louder than a happy mockingjay twirling around to music? I find Prim in the crowd. Since winter evenings gave us a lot of time to practice, we're actually pretty good partners. I brush off her concerns about my ribs, and we take our places in the line. It hurts, but the satisfaction of having Snow watch me dance with my little sister reduces other feelings to dust. Dancing transforms us. We teach the steps to the District 13 guests, insist on a special number for the bride and groom, join hands and make a giant spinning circle where people show off their footwork. Nothing silly, joyful, or fun has happened in so long. This could go on all night if not for the last event planned in Plutarch's propo. One I hadn't heard about, but then it was meant to be a surprise. Four people wheel out a huge wedding cake from a side room. Most of the guests back up, making way for this rarity, this dazzling creation with blue-green, white-tipped icing waves, swimming with fish and sailboats, seals and sea flowers. But I push my way through the crowd to confirm what I knew at first sight. As surely as the embroidery stitches in Annie's gown were done by Cinna's hand, the frosted flowers on the cake were done by Peeta's. This may seem like a small thing, but it speaks volumes. Haymitch has been keeping a great deal from me. The boy I last saw, screaming his head off, trying to tear free of his restraints, could never have made this. Never have had the focus, kept his hands steady, designed something so perfect for Finnick and Annie. As if anticipating my reaction, Haymitch is at my side.
"Let's you and me have a talk," he says.
Out in the hall, away from the cameras, I ask, "What's happening to him?" Haymitch shakes his head.
"I don't know. None of us knows. Sometimes he's almost rational, and then for no reason, he goes off again. Doing the cake was a kind of therapy. He's been working on it for days. Watching him, he seemed almost like before."
"So he's got the run of the place?" I ask. The idea makes me nervous on about five different levels.
"Oh, no. He frosted under heavy guard. He's still under lock and key.
But I've talked to him," Haymitch says. "Face to face?" I ask. "And he didn't go nuts?"
"No. Pretty angry with me. But for all the right reasons, not telling him about the rebel plot and whatnot."
Haymitch pauses a moment, as if deciding something.
"He says he'd like to see you."
I'm on a frosting sailboat, tossed around by blue-green waves, the deck shifting beneath my feet. My palms press into the wall to steady myself. This wasn't part of the plan. I wrote Peeta off in two. Then I was to go to the capital, kill Snow, and get taken out myself. The gunshot was only a temporary setback. Never was I supposed to hear the words, "He says he'd like to see you." But now that I have, there's no way to refuse. At midnight, I'm standing outside the door to his cell, hospital room. We had to wait for Plutarch to finish getting his wedding footage, which, despite the lack of what he calls razzle-dazzle, he's pleased with.
The best thing about the Capitol basically ignoring 12 all these years is that you people still have a little spontaneity. The audience eats that up, like when Peter announced he was in love with you, or you did the trick with the berries. Makes for good television.
I wish I could meet with Peter privately, but the audience of doctors has assembled behind the one-way glass, clipboards ready, pens poised. When Haymitch gives me the okay in my earpiece, I slowly open the door. Those blue eyes lock on me instantly. He's got 3 restraints on each arm and a tube that can dispense a knockout drug just in case he loses control. He doesn't fight to free himself, though, only observes me with the wary look of someone who still hasn't ruled out that he's in the presence of a mutt. I walk over until I'm standing about a yard from the bed. There's nothing to do with my hands, so I cross my arms protectively over my ribs before I speak. "Hey!"
"Hey," he responds.
It's like his voice, almost his voice, except there's something new in it, an edge of suspicion and reproach.
"Haymitch said you wanted to talk to me," I say. "Look at you, for starters."
It's like he's waiting for me to transform into a hybrid drooling wolf right before his eyes. He stares so long I find myself casting furtive glances at the one-way glass, hoping for some direction from Haymitch, but my earpiece stays silent.
"You're not very big, are you? Or particularly pretty?"
I know he's been through hell and back, and yet somehow the observation rubs me the wrong way. "Well, you've looked better." Haymitch's advice to back off gets muffled by Peter's laughter.
"And not even remotely nice, to say that to me after all I've been through?"
"Yeah, we've all been through a lot. And you're the one who was known for being nice, not me." I'm doing everything wrong. I don't know why I feel so defensive. He's been tortured. He's been hijacked. What's wrong with me? Suddenly, I think I might start screaming at him. I'm not even sure about what, so I decide to get out of there. "Look, I don't feel so well. Maybe I'll drop by tomorrow." I've just reached the door when his voice stops me.
"Katniss, I remember about the bread."
The bread? Our one moment of real connection before the Hunger Games. "They showed you the tape of me talking about it," I say.
"No. Is there a tape of you talking about it? Why didn't the Capitol use it against me?" he asks.
"I made it the day you were rescued," I answer. The pain in my chest wraps around my ribs like a vice. The dancing was a mistake.
"So what do you remember?" "You, in the rain," he says softly, "digging in our trash bins, burning the bread, my mother hitting me, taking the bread out for the pigs, but then giving it to you instead."
"That's it. That's what happened," I say. "The next day after school, I wanted to thank you, but I didn't know how."
"We were outside at the end of the day. I tried to catch your eye. You looked away. And then, for some reason, I think you picked a dandelion."
I nod. He does remember. I have never spoken about that moment aloud.
"I must have loved you a lot."
"You did." My voice catches, and I pretend to cough.
"And did you love me?" he asks.
I keep my eyes on the tiled floor. "Everyone says I did. Everyone says that's why Snow had you tortured, to break me."
"That's not an answer," he tells me. "I don't know what to think when they show me some of the tapes. In that first arena, it looked like you tried to kill me with those tracker jackers."
"I was trying to kill all of you," I say. "You had me treed."
"Later, there's a lot of kissing. Didn't seem very genuine on your part. Did you like kissing me?"
he asks. Sometimes, I admit. You know, people are watching us now.
I know. What about Gale?
He continues. My anger's returning. I don't care about his recovery. This isn't the business of the people behind the glass. He's not a bad kisser either, I say shortly.
And it was okay with both of us? You kissing the other?
He asks. No, it wasn't okay with either of you. But I wasn't asking your permission, I tell him. Peter laughs again, coldly, dismissively.
Well, you're a piece of work, aren't you?
Hamish doesn't protest when I walk out, down the hall, through the beehive of compartments, find a warm pipe to hide behind in a laundry room. It takes a long time before I get to the bottom of why I'm so upset. When I do, it's almost too mortifying to admit. All those months of taking it for granted that Peter thought I was wonderful are over. Finally, he can see me for who I really am. Violent, distrustful, manipulative, deadly. And I hate him for it.
Chapter 17. Blindsided. That's how I feel when Hamish tells me in the hospital. I fly down the steps to command, mind racing a mile a minute, and burst right into a war meeting.
What do you mean? I'm not going to the Capitol? I have to go. I'm the Mockingjay, I say.
Coyne barely looks up from her screen. And as the Mockingjay, your primary goal of unifying the districts against the Capitol has been achieved. Don't worry. If it goes well, we'll fly you in for the surrender.
The surrender? That'll be too late. I'll miss all the fighting. You need me. I'm the best shot you've got, I shout.
I don't usually brag about this, but it's got to be at least close to true.
Gail's going.
Gale has shown up for training every day unless occupied with other approved duties. We feel confident he can manage himself in the field, says Coyne. How many training sessions do you estimate you've attended?
None. That's how many.
Well, sometimes I was hunting, and I trained with Beatty down in special weaponry.
It's not the same, Katniss, says Boggs. We all know you're smart and brave and a good shot, but we need soldiers in the field. You don't know the first thing about executing orders, and you're not exactly at your physical peak.
That didn't bother you when I was in 8, or 2 for that matter, I counter.
You weren't originally authorized for combat in either case, says Plutarch, shooting me a look that signals I'm about to reveal too much.
No, the bomber battle in 8 and my intervention in 2 were spontaneous, rash, and definitely unauthorized.
And both resulted in your injury, Boggs reminds me.
Suddenly, I see myself through his eyes, a smallish 17-year-old girl who can't quite catch her breath since her ribs haven't fully healed, disheveled, undisciplined, recuperating, not a soldier, but someone who needs to be looked after.
But I have to go, I say.
Why? Asks Coyne.
I can't very well say. It's so I can carry out my own personal vendetta against Snow. Or that the idea of remaining here in 13 with the latest version of PETA while Gale goes off to fight is unbearable. But I have no shortage of reasons to want to fight in the Capitol. Because of 12. Because they destroyed my district. The President thinks about this a moment, considers me.
Well, you have 3 weeks. It's not long, but you can begin training. If the assignment board deems you fit, possibly your case will be reviewed.
That's it. That's the most I can hope for. I guess it's my own fault. I did blow off my schedule every single day, unless something suited me. It didn't seem like much of a priority, jogging around a field with a gun, with so many other things going on. And now I'm paying for my negligence.
Back in the hospital, I find Joanna in the same circumstance and spitting mad. I tell her about what Coyne said. Maybe you can train, too.
Fine, I'll train. But I'm going to the stinking capital if I have to kill a crew and fly there myself, says Joanna.
Probably best not to bring that up in training, I say. But it's nice to know I'll have a ride. Joanna grins, and I feel a slight but significant shift in our relationship. I don't know that we're actually friends, but possibly the word allies would be accurate. That's good. I'm going to need an ally. The next morning, when we report for training at 07:30, reality slaps me in the face. We've been funneled into a class of relative beginners, 14 or 15-year-olds, which seems a little insulting until it's obvious that they're in far better condition than we are. Gale and the other people already chosen to go to the capital are in a different, accelerated phase of training. After we stretch, which hurts, there's a couple of hours of strengthening exercises, which hurt, and a 5-mile run, which kills. Even with Joanna's motivational insults driving me on, I have to drop out after a mile. It's my ribs, I explain to the trainer, a no-nonsense middle-aged woman we're supposed to address as Soldier York. They're still bruised.
Well, I'll tell you, Soldier Everdeen, those are going to take at least another month to heal up on their own, she says.
I shake my head. I don't have a month. She looks me up and down.
The doctors haven't offered you any treatment?
Is there a treatment? I ask. They said they had to mend naturally.
That's what they say. But they could speed up the process if I recommend it. I warn you, though, it isn't any fun, she tells me.
Please, I've got to get to the capital, I say. Soldier York doesn't question this. She scribbles something on a pad and sends me directly back to the hospital. I hesitate. I don't want to miss any more training. I'll be back for the afternoon session, I promise.
She just purses her lips.
24 needle jabs to my ribcage later, I'm flattened out on my hospital bed, gritting my teeth to keep from begging them to bring back my morphling drip. It's been by my bed, so I can take a hit as needed. I haven't used it lately, but I kept it for Joanna's sake. Today they tested my blood to make sure it was clean of the painkiller, as the mixture of the two drugs, the morphling and whatever set my ribs on fire, has dangerous side effects. They made it clear I would have a difficult couple of days, but I told them to go ahead. It's a bad night in our room. Sleep's out of the question. I think I can actually smell the ring of flesh around my chest burning, and Joanna's fighting off withdrawal symptoms. Early on, when I apologize about cutting off her morphling supply, she waved it off, saying it had to happen anyway. But by 3 in the morning, I'm the target of every colorful bit of profanity District 7 has to offer. At dawn, she drags me out of bed, determined to get to training. I don't think I can do it, I confess.
You can do it. We both can. We're victors, remember? We're the ones who can survive anything they throw at us, she snarls at me.
She's a sick greenish color, shaking like a leaf. I get dressed.
We must be victors to make it through the morning. I think I'm going to lose Joanna when we realize it's pouring outside.
Her face turns ashen, and she seems to have ceased breathing.
It's just water. It won't kill us, I say.
She clenches her jaw and stomps out into the mud. Rain drenches us as we work our bodies and then slog around the running course. I bail after a mile again, and I have to resist the temptation to take off my shirt so the cold water can sizzle off my ribs. I force down my field lunch of soggy fish and beet stew. Joanna gets halfway through her bowl before it comes back up. In the afternoon, we learn to assemble our guns. I manage it, but Joanna can't hold her hand steady enough to fit the parts together. When York's back is turned, I help her out. Even though the rain continues, the afternoon's an improvement because we're on the shooting range. At last, something I'm good at. It takes some adjusting from a bow to a gun, but by the end of the day, I've got the best score in my class. We're just inside the hospital doors when Joanna declares, "This has to stop. Us living in the hospital. Everyone views us as patients." It's not a problem for me. I can move into our family compartment, but Joanna's never been assigned one. When she tries to get discharged from the hospital, they won't agree to let her live alone, even if she comes in for daily talks with the head doctor. I think they may have put two and two together about the morphling, and this only adds to their view that she's unstable. "She won't be alone. I'm going to room with her," I announce. There's some dissent, but Hamish takes our part, and by bedtime, we have a compartment across from Prim and my mother, who agrees to keep an eye on us. After I take a shower, and Joanna sort of wipes herself down with a damp cloth, she makes a cursory inspection of the place. When she opens the drawer that holds my few possessions, she shuts it quickly. "Sorry." I think how there's nothing in Joanna's drawer but her government-issued clothes, that she doesn't have one thing in the world to call her own. "It's okay. You can look at my stuff if you want." Joanna unlatches my locket, studying the pictures of Gail, Prim, and my mother. She opens the silver parachute and pulls out the spile and slips it onto her pinky. Makes me thirsty just looking at it. Then she finds the pearl Peeta gave me. "Is this?" "Yeah," I say. "Made it through somehow." I don't want to talk about Peeta. One of the best things about training is it keeps me from thinking of him. "Hamish says he's getting better," she says. "Maybe, but he's changed," I say.
"So have you. So have I. And Finnick, and Hamish, and Beattie. Don't get me started on Annie Cresta. The arena messed us all up pretty good, don't you think? Or do you still feel like the girl who volunteered for your sister?" she asks me. "No," I answer. "That's the one thing I think my head doctor might be right about. There's no going back. So we might as well get on with things." She neatly returns my keepsakes to the drawer and climbs into the bed across from me just as the lights go out. "You're not afraid I'll kill you tonight?" "Like I couldn't take you," I answer. Then we laugh. Since both our bodies are so wrecked, it will be a miracle if we can get up the next day. But we do. Each morning, we do. And by the end of the week, my ribs feel almost like new, and Joanna can assemble her rifle without help. Soldier York gives the pair of us an approving nod as we knock off for the day. "Fine job, soldiers."
When we move out of hearing, Joanna mutters,
"I think winning the games was easier."
But the look on her face says she's pleased. In fact, we're almost in good spirits when we go to the dining hall where Gail's waiting to eat with me. Receiving a giant serving of beef stew doesn't hurt my mood either.
"First shipments of food arrived this morning," Greasy Say tells me. "That's real beef from District 10, not any of your wild dog." "Don't remember you turning it down," Gail tosses back.
We join a group that includes Deli, Annie, and Finnick. It's something to see Finnick's transformation since his marriage. His earlier incarnations, the decadent capital heartthrob I met before the Quell, the enigmatic ally in the arena, the broken young man who tried to help me hold it together. These have been replaced by someone who radiates life. Finnick's real charms of self-effacing humor and an easygoing nature are on display for the first time. He never lets go of Annie's hand. Not when they walk, not when they eat. I doubt he ever plans to. She's lost in some daze of happiness. There are still moments when you can tell something slips in her brain and another world blinds her to us. But a few words from Finnick call her back. Deli, who I've known since I was little but never gave much thought to, has grown in my estimation. She knows what Peeta said to me that night after the wedding, but she's not a gossip. Haymitch says she's the best defender I have when Peeta goes off on some kind of tear about me, always taking my side, blaming his negative perceptions on the capital's torture. She has more influence on him than any of the others do, because he really does know her. Anyway, even if she's sugarcoating my good points, I appreciate it. Frankly, I could use a little sugarcoating. I'm starving, and the stew is so delicious, beef, potatoes, turnips, and onions in a thick gravy, that I have to force myself to slow down. All around the dining hall, you can feel the rejuvenating effect that a good meal can bring on. The way it can make people kinder, funnier, more optimistic, and remind them it's not a mistake to go on living. It's better than any medicine. So I try to make it last and join in the conversation, sop up the gravy on my bread, and nibble on it as I listen to Finnick telling some ridiculous story about a sea turtle swimming off with his hat. Laugh before I realize he's standing there, directly across the table behind the empty seat next to Joanna, watching me. I choke momentarily as the gravy bread sticks in my throat. "Peeta," says Deli, "it's so nice to see you out and about." Two large guards stand behind him. He holds his tray awkwardly, balanced on his fingertips, as his wrists are shackled with a short chain between them. "What's with the fancy bracelets?" asks Joanna.
"I'm not quite trustworthy yet," says Peeta. "I can't even sit here without your permission."
He indicates the guards with his head.
"Sure he can sit here. We're old friends," says Joanna, patting the space beside her.
The guards nod, and Peeta takes a seat.
"Peeta and I had adjoining cells in the capital. We're very familiar with each other's screams."
Annie, who's on Joanna's other side, does that thing where she covers her ears and exits reality. Finnick shoots Joanna an angry look as his arm encircles Annie.
"What?" "My head doctor says I'm not supposed to censor my thoughts. It's part of my therapy," replies Joanna.
The life has gone out of our little party. Finnick murmurs things to Annie until she slowly removes her hands. Then there's a long silence while people pretend to eat.
"Annie," says Deli brightly, "did you know it was Peeta who decorated your wedding cake? Back home, his family ran the bakery and he did all the icing."
Annie cautiously looks across Joanna.
"Thank you, Peeta. It was beautiful."
"My pleasure, Annie," says Peeta,
and I hear that old note of gentleness in his voice that I thought was gone forever. Not that it's directed at me, but still.
"If we're going to fit in that walk, we better go," Finnick tells her.
He arranges both of their trays so he can carry them in one hand while holding tightly to her with the other.
"Good seeing you, Peeta."
"You be nice to her, Finnick, or I might try and take her away from you."
It could be a joke if the tone wasn't so cold. Everything it conveys is wrong. The open distrust of Finnick, the implication that he has his eye on Annie, that Annie could desert Finnick, that I do not even exist.
"Oh, Peeta," says Finnick lightly, "don't make me sorry I restarted your heart."
He leads Annie away after giving me a concerned glance. When they're gone, Deli says in a reproachful voice,
"He did save your life, Peeta, more than once."
"For her," he gives me a brief nod. "For the rebellion, not for me. I don't owe him anything."
I shouldn't rise to the bait, but I do.
"Maybe not, but Mags is dead and you're still here. That should count for something."
"Yeah, a lot of things should count for something that don't seem to, Katniss. I've got some memories I can't make sense of, and I don't think the Capitol touched them. A lot of nights on the train, for instance," he says.
Again, the implications, that more happened on the train than did. That what did happen Those nights I only kept my sanity because his arms were around me no longer matters. Everything a lie. Everything a way of misusing him. Peter makes a little gesture with his spoon, connecting Gale and me.
So, are you two officially a couple now, or are they still dragging out the star-crossed lover thing?
Still dragging, says Joanna. Spasms cause Peter's hands to tighten into fists, then splay out in a bizarre fashion. Is it all he can do to keep them from my neck? I can feel the tension in Gale's muscles next to me, fear and altercation. But Gale simply says,
I wouldn't have believed it if I hadn't seen it myself.
What's that? Asks Peter.
You, Gale answers. You'll have to be a little more specific, says Peter. What about me?
That they've replaced you with the evil mutt version of yourself, says Joanna. Gale finishes his milk.
You done? He asks me. I rise, and we cross to drop off our trays.
At the door, an old man stops me because I'm still clutching the rest of my gravy bread in my hand. Something in my expression, or maybe the fact that I've made no attempt to conceal it, makes him go easy on me. He lets me stuff the bread in my mouth and move on. Gale and I are almost to my compartment when he speaks again.
I didn't expect that.
I told you he hated me, I say.
It's the way he hates you. It's so familiar. I used to feel like that, he admits. When I'd watch you kissing him on the screen. Only I knew I wasn't being entirely fair. He can't see that.
We reach my door. Maybe he just sees me as I really am. I have to get some sleep. Gale catches my arm before I can disappear.
So that's what you're thinking now?
I shrug.
Katniss, as your oldest friend, believe me when I say he's not seeing you as you really are.
He kisses my cheek and goes. I sit on my bed, trying to stuff information from my military tactics books into my head while memories of my nights with Peter on the train distract me. After about 20 minutes, Joanna comes in and throws herself across the foot of my bed.
You missed the best part. Deli lost her temper at Peta over how he treated you. She got very squeaky. It was like someone stabbing a mouse with a fork repeatedly. The whole dining hall was riveted.
What'd Peta do? I ask.
He started arguing with himself like he was two people. The guards had to take him away. On the good side, no one seemed to notice I finished his stew.
Joanna rubs her hand over her protruding belly. I look at the layer of grime under her fingernails. Wonder if the people in Seven ever bathe. We spend a couple of hours quizzing each other on military terms. I visit my mother and Prim for a while. When I'm back in my compartment, showered, staring into the darkness, I finally ask, Joanna, could you really hear him screaming?
That was part of it, she says. Like the jabberjays in the arena. Only it was real. And it didn't stop after an hour. Tick-tock.
Tick-tock, I whisper back. Roses, wolf mutts, tributes, frosted dolphins, friends, mockingjays, stylists, me. Everything screams in my dreams tonight.
Chapter 18. I throw myself into training with a vengeance. Eat, live, and breathe the workouts, drills, weapons practice, lectures on tactics. A handful of us are moved into an additional class that gives me hope I may be a contender for the actual war. The soldiers simply call it the block, but the tattoo on my arm lists it as SSC, short for Simulated Street Combat. Deep in 13, they've built an artificial capital city block. The instructor breaks us into squads of 8, and we attempt to carry out missions, gaining a position, destroying a target, searching a home,
as if we were really fighting our way through the capital. The thing's rigged so that everything that can go wrong for you does. A false step triggers a landmine. A sniper appears on a rooftop. Your gun jams. A crying child leads you into an ambush. Your squadron leader, who's just a voice on the program, gets hit by a mortar, and you have to figure out what to do without orders. Part of you knows it's fake and that they're not going to kill you. If you set off a landmine, you hear the explosion and have to pretend to fall over dead. But in other ways, it feels pretty real in there. The enemy soldiers dressed in peacekeepers' uniforms, the confusion of a smoke bomb. They even gas us. Joanna and I are the only ones who get our masks on in time. The rest of our squad gets knocked out for 10 minutes. And the supposedly harmless gas I took a few lungfuls of gives me a wicked headache for the rest of the day. Cressida and her crew tape Joanna and me on the firing range. I know Gail and Finnick are being filmed as well. It's part of a new Propos series to show the rebels preparing for the capital invasion. On the whole, things are going pretty well. Then PETA starts showing up for our morning workouts. The manacles are off, but he's still constantly accompanied by a pair of guards. After lunch, I see him across the field, drilling with a group of beginners. I don't know what they're thinking. If a spat with Deli can reduce him to arguing with himself, he's got no business learning how to assemble a gun. When I confront Plutarch, he assures me that it's all for the camera. They've got footage of Annie getting married and Joanna hitting targets, but all of Panem is wondering about PETA. They need to see he's fighting for the rebels, not for Snow. And maybe if they could just get a couple of shots of the two of us, not kissing necessarily, just looking happy to be back together. I walk away from the conversation right then. That's not going to happen. In my rare moments of downtime, I anxiously watch the preparations for the invasions, see equipment and provisions readied, divisions assembled. You can tell when someone's received orders because they're given a very short haircut, the mark of someone going into battle. There is much talk of the opening offensive, which will be to secure the train tunnels that feed up into the capital. Just a few days before the first troops are to move out, York unexpectedly tells Joanna and me she's recommended us for the exam, and we're to report